Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us again today. I think we need to talk, brethren. We need to recognize that what we can do, or the potential of the order, is impactful. And at any point, I think it goes without saying that, you know, a world operating on virtue is a better world. I'd like to debate that with whoever wishes, but it isn't easy, is it? We engage in struggle, and we seem to tolerate that. That's the new. For a long, long time, struggle has been the new benchmark, the new norm, if you use that kind of language. In fact, we've gone beyond that to convince ourselves that the competition is primary. And yet it is one way of course, it's one way of living and one way of thinking, but it's not the only one. As for hundreds of years, and even before the founding of Grand Lodges, Masonry was pivoting on some remarkable ideas. It was as if the tide that was coming in with Renaissance and then the period of the Enlightenment did have impact on people, not just the large estates, not just on government and science and church, but on the people themselves. And again, this isn't a generality, is it? I don't think. There has always been that, you know, the person with more talent or in a particular area, that when there was a need, the people would turn and go to for advice or for assistance. We've known that, and we've benefited, I think, without question, we've benefited from the observations and the care, the diligence of other human beings to help us understand and look at the world conceptually different, to be able to think that there's something beyond what's visible. And how long ago, we know that this was happening, thousands of years ago, thousands and thousands of years ago in in the history of humanity. And even though we're burdened with some very, very clumsy language these days, it was going on. You think about the very first time these first symbols, the first information that tells us this was happening is our art. What we painted, what we stained on the rocks. It's still there. The stories that it told, or the graffiti, I was here, there's my hand. I was there, I was on that hunt, commemorating a success. And I'm not going to romanticize it, saying there's a difference. If you're very hungry and your hunt, the survival of the tribe depends on the success of your hunt. I'm not going to compare that to what I'm sitting in, the luxury that I sit in today. Not a bit. Our discussions are different when survival is the issue. So we don't have to be silly about comparing the importance. They are each elements important in their own time and in their own way. To think that not only did we want to change our conduct toward each other, but we were, when we started to look at ideas around universality and notions of equality, we began, apparently, well, we did. We began to realize that there was something more than the privilege to which we were born. I know the pop psychology will want to tell us that, it's not so much pop psychology, sorry. There is a notion that anybody can succeed at anything, anytime, and that's a bit of like rolling the dice. It's like rolling the dice and you're going to come up with sixes every time. It doesn't, you and I know that doesn't happen. We do know that we can have a personal drive to better ourselves. It doesn't have nearly as much sex appeal as saying I can be anything I want to be at any time. Well, that may be fun to say in a way, if I work very hard, is my life better or different? If I am law abiding, is my life better or different? Yeah, it is. If I try to understand this sense of a higher power, is my life different or better? We can set individual goals that I will work. The notion that I can be anything. Well, when we were younger, that works very well, doesn't it? I can be anything. I don't have to put up with. And when our surroundings, or we're brought up by people that are dangerous to our well-being, which is a great many of us in the world, we need that kind of drive. We need to be able to instill that sense that with hard work and diligence, you can become something. We need some tools to get there. Yeah, along the way. It's not just going to be because I wish it to happen. It takes more than that. Although in our world of clipped art, that part of the conversation is usually cut off. What else does it take? I want to be a musician. Well, it takes an effort, doesn't it? Learn music. It takes a uniqueness and perhaps a sense of something, the uniqueness, and bringing it to an audience, letting the audience know that you're there, your talent is there, so they can find that, they can find it for themselves. And we know that music appeals. And some people love entertaining. They love to see the smile, the joy, the effect that they have, that their music has on you and others. Other people would wrinkle their nose and say, you know, it's impossible. It's far, far too much work. The same mindset works with the biologist, the chemist, the physicist, the mathematician, the historian, the sociologist, psychologist. We do go through trends where some levels of education are more prominent, more pronounced, more heavily advertised than others. Right now in North America, education, the governors of education have to, and not only in North America, but the governors of higher education have to weigh off the purity of intellectual discovery with the practicality of paying the bills, paying the talent. And so we know what generates revenue. We know business generates revenue. So a lot of our training is being tailored toward jobs, occupations. That's not to say we're going to erase the benefit of the liberal arts. We know that the major business schools underwent a bit of a reality check about 2008 when we found ourselves dealing with the outcome of some very, very unethical business practices. And on closer examination, I understand that some of the more prestigious schools like Harvard had found that they had taken ethics out of their portfolio. Well, the question is, well, of course, if you're not teaching ethics, how do you expect your graduates to embrace an ethical frame of mind? And no, it's that dog eat dog. Take the big risk with other people's money. And if you're lucky, you get all of the praise and accolades. And if you're not, well, I would never anymore, and I still hear, it's 2023, I still hear people laughing at education, mocking education. I don't know what their point is. It makes all of us appear quite silly. But now, why would thoughtless people, today, we're realizing if you're at all a fan of her work, Templum Grandin, Professor Grandin, is opening up our knowledge base to that whole autistic spectrum, different ways of thinking, and she's talking to us now about visual learning as well as verbal learning. So equipped with that, she goes on to say, she's done. Smart woman, smart, very smart person. She's gone on to say, "This is the you call it cruelty or the embarrassment. You know, when you were in school at a younger age, you were streamed. If you were smart, you were going to university. If not, you were going to the trades." What she points out is the mistake with that. And I get some joy from that. My education was ridiculous, and it wasn't the examples that are trotted out when this argument comes up. It was the reality of people that had no business doing that. Had very, very, it was a job back then, and you could, poorly equipped. That has changed. That has changed. Expectations have changed. But she teaches us that that mindset, visual learners, are necessary and are capable of doing things that verbal learners cannot, and vice versa. All of a sudden, it changes. If we accept the logic of what she's saying and her observations, the science that supports it, and the results of her work, the credibility of her work, And then we want to be rethinking this notion that it's not organic. What do they call it? Structural functionalism. The Talcott Parsons kind of Talcott Parsons. Is it the idea that our societies are not created or mastered by one profession, but that it's all. It doesn't work. The city doesn't work without the planners, without the lawyers, without the plumbers, without the street cleaners, without the people taking our cast-offs and processing it. It's integration. We need education. We need teachers. We need hospitals and doctors and specialists. We need a lively political conversation going on. Politics being overarching conversation about who we are and what we're doing. What we're doing next and how we're addressing issues that come up day by day. And it never ends. It just changes. It evolves constantly. The theory, and I've been an adherent of this for my goodness now, 50 years, whew, that it takes these entire groups, different strata, to make these organizations, these structures perform. So try and run your business when the place is filthy or the water is unsafe. Try that. Or when they try to run your business when the power goes off and you need specialists that understand how to restore these things. And okay, so we can now point a finger at art. Art is irrelevant. All the higher arts, all the, opera, symphony, it's all irrelevant. The art galleries, you could do without them, except when we take the question seriously, we find that there's something happens in the cultures that enhance the arts. So what that is, if I would say smugly, if you have to ask, then you're not part of that culture. But you know that's crass. My thinking is that is a matter of time. Whether it's the line on the old car, that swoopy line, or those great big fins that were so popular in these enormous Detroit behemoths that were produced in the 50s. There's something lyrical and beautiful in music, and it's changed from the very first rock concerts. The very first rock concerts, as you scratch the surface, were opera, and they were to say we can go to a rock concert today, but imagine a time when you were at the first one, and imagine the energy in the room when you were there. You went with your best mate or your wife or your girl with that sense of anticipation, and the doors were blown off. You saw for the very first time symphony and theater and dance being brought together and song brought together at the same time. All of the with the stage settings and with the costuming coordinated, curated, thoughtfully put together with music that was transcendent. Not only the human voice, the beautiful music, but a libretto that was, able to touch us the way that Shakespeare's work continues to touch generations of people around the world. And imagine you were there And what would you do, what was going through your mind when you heard the roar of the that spontaneous roar of the of appreciation at the end, the applause, the waves of applause? What did that do? Well, what it did was it changed our language. It changed the world because the experience was a rush. It was that frisson that never went away. Even today, we have rock concerts. We look down our nose of who wants to perform opera. You know, it's hundreds of years old and it's tedious. It went in, it did not stop at that first performance. Oh no! It went on to be refined. And did it give up some of the beauty? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Unless you can do better, we will continue to play. We will continue with the operas of Mozart and Beethoven's one and only, and Puccini. We will, and Verdi. We will continue because they've got. I would say, you know, you can write a book of sonnets for me. Write a sonnet, and I will love that sonnet. But will I pack away Shakespeare or Sidney Philip Sidney's work? No. We're not going to do that. Add to the lexicon. Add, and that's what we do today. Only who acknowledges, who benefits. Those that care to experience it. When you're in the audience, you stop looking at the people with their furs and thinking of them as snooty or anything like that. And you begin to think that here, everybody is an aficionado. Everybody loves is here because they want to be, and they love this. They love this art form because it has a reputation. But also in the room will be people there for the very first time. And you sit in the dark, so you're not so obvious. And you experience every part of it. You experience the beauty, the arias that bring tears to your eyes. You experience the effort of the tenor that is takes your breath away. And you do that on your own, in your own way. Some men will still be, some men I find struggle with this, which is odd in a way. To be able to show that they can connect emotionally with what's going on. Some men can cry at a movie or with a story, and some men don't know how to access that. But externally, all people cry. Some cry internally, some cry on the outside. You come from a family of culture of Stoics, then not so obvious. But to say that they aren't feeling sadness by the weeping and tearing their shirt, no. That's just not part of it. We've come together here tonight. You've come together here. This is Masonic Effects, and thank you for tuning in. Let's get on with the. Shall we get on with the show? This is. I'm going to need your help more than others. And I know every time we put together a show, it's like, we struggle. There is a sense of expectation. Is this to your liking? There's never that smugness that, oh, we have all the answers in here. We're just going to pour our wisdom on the world. We're just like you. Struggling, coming along, and searching, always searching. No, we're not done. Focus and effort, the commentary today. The music, it's fitting. It's fitting. But the poetry today, the Sonnet 1 by Philip Sidney. We're going to sit down and look at something quite beautiful. Listen to something quite beautiful today. But I'd like to go and refresh myself and give you a chance to top up your favorite espresso cappuccino. It's, you know, wherever you are, or your beverage du jour. And we'll be right back. In the meantime, check this out. This is Cannonball Adderley and John Coltrane. So from an album they did in 1959. Yeah. A while ago in Chicago. Here, see what you think. That'll do. That'll do. Can you help me with this? Can you help me with this, brethren? Around the world, men join together to perform the rituals of Freemasonry. Of course, there are those that had compatibility in mind from the start. No choice is offered. Study and you will be rewarded for your efforts. Be aware and you will find yourself. These ideas occur more in some lodges than others. Matching the ceremony with enhanced discussion in an atmosphere of cordiality that has appeal to a man comfortable with the finer things in life. Self-awareness isn't self-consciousness. Excitable types take their seat where mature judgment is comfortable, where they begin to learn about a world in which we learn how to be impactful, how to influence others in a positive way. Our behavior, the way we speak, what we speak about, it all becomes purposeful. All is made possible by understanding meaning and context. Within the craft, we are taught alternative interpretations. Best, of course, in hindsight, that we bring in men capable of reasoning to save them confusion. By reputation alone, if not by character, a Mason takes on a different persona. Our assignments are not so difficult. The fields we study are from a time when science and belief were accepted to complement one another. We weren't at odds. Mentors show us possibilities and encourage us to begin unraveling mysteries of the universe. We are shown that if we look for common traits, we can find them in other men. Conflict becomes differences. Opposition becomes spectrums on which mankind finds itself. Trying to explore the workings of one's mind is an exercise of awareness in which you alone determine how far you travel. But it's fun. While learning patience, thinking strategically had its own rewards. Being honest, transparent is always daunting. Saying we have no regrets in life is not the same as admitting them. We're not the same men we were when we were young. Experience teaches a wise man, but not every man. He learns that service to others is transformative for him as well as the recipient in ways that again alter purpose of life. All of that. What was it like for you? Wow. Poetry. Poetry corner. I like the idea. Why poetry? I think it's important. This is a, I'm picking up some material from the Harvard Business Review. I know I find that whole term a bit lugubrious, but let's admit that there is some precision happening at Harvard. Here we're talking about the benefits of poetry for professionals, and I don't mean to separate the crowd. I think if you can listen to it without that, this is Harvard, so they're going to talk about professionals. They want to enhance your sensibilities, but I don't think I need that here. Poetry teaches us, it's said. Here, this, you're talking about Hartford Insurance and an indemnity company, you know, that references from the administrators. This, and they're talking about a lyrically inclined executive, far from alone in occupying the intersect of business and poetry. Dana Gioia, a poet, Stanford Business School grad, and former General Foods executive, notes that T.S. Eliot spent a decade at Lloyd's Bank of London, and many other poets, James Dickey, A.R. Ammons, and Edmund Clarence Stedman, navigated stints in business. The writer has explained in the past how business leaders should be readers, but even those of us prone to read avidly often restrict ourselves to contemporary nonfiction or novels. And by doing so, we overlook a genre that could be valuable to our personal and professional development, poetry. Here's why we shouldn't overlook it. For one, poetry teaches us to wrestle with and simplify complexity. Harman Industries founder Sidney Harman once told the New York Times, "I used to tell my senior staff to get me poets as managers. Poets are our original systems thinkers. They look at our most complex environments and they reduce the complexity to something they begin to understand." Emily Dickinson, for example, masterfully simplified complex topics with poems like "Because I Could Not Stop for Death." And many poets are similarly adept. Business leaders live in multifaceted, dynamic environments. Their challenge is to take that chaos and make it meaningful and understandable. Reading and writing poetry can exercise that capacity, improving one's ability to better conceptualize the world and communicate it through presentations or writings to others. Poetry can also help users develop a more acute sense of empathy. In the poem Celestial Music, for example, Louise Gluck explores her feelings on heaven and mortality by seeing the issue through the eyes of a friend. And many poets focus intensely on understanding the people around them. In January 2006, the Poetry Foundation released a landmark study, Poetry in America. Mm-hmm. I know. Outlining trends in reading poetry and characteristics of poetry readers. The number one thematic benefit poetry users cited was that understanding of the world, the self, and others. They were even found to be more sociable than their non-poetry using counterparts. And bevies of new research show that reading fiction and poetry more broadly develops empathy. Raymond Marr, for example, has conducted studies showing fiction reading is essential to developing empathy in young children and empathy in theory in minds of adults. You can find this material, by the way. They're in PDF forms. Raymond Marr, M-A-R. The Program of Medical Humanities and Arts is another one. Even included poetry in their curriculum as a way of enhancing empathy and compassion in doctors. And the intense empathy developed by so many poets is a skill essential to those who occupy executive suites and regularly need to understand the feelings and motivations of board members, colleagues, customers, suppliers, community members, and employees. Reading and writing poetry also develops creativity. In an interview with Knowledge at Wharton, W-H-A-R-T-O-N, the aforementioned Dana Gioia says, as I rose in business, I felt I had an enormous advantage over my colleagues because I had a background in imagination, in language, and in literature, noting that the Greek root for poetry means maker. Dana emphasizes that senior executives need not just quantitative skills, but qualitative and creative skills and creative judgment, and feels reading and writing poetry is a route to developing those capabilities. Indeed, poetry may be an even better tool for developing creativity than conventional fiction. Claire Morgan, in her book, What Poetry Brings to Business, cites a study showing that poems caused readers to generate nearly twice as many alternative meanings as stories. And poetry readers further developed greater self-monitoring strategies that enhanced the efficacy of their thinking processes. These creative capabilities can help executives keep their organizations entrepreneurial, draw imaginative solutions, and navigate disruptive environments where data alone are insufficient to make progress. And finally, poetry can teach us to infuse life with beauty and meaning. Oh, I can't have too much of that. A challenge in modern management can be to keep ourselves and our colleagues invested with wonder and purpose. As Simon Sinek and others have documented, the best companies and people never lose a sense of why they do what they do. Neither do poets. In her Nobel lecture, The Poet and the World, Wisława Szymborska writes, "The world, whatever we might think when terrified by its vastness and our own impotence, is astonishing." Sonnet 1 by Sir Philip Sidney, 16th century guy. Loving in truth and fain in verse my love to show, that she, dear she, might take some pleasure of my pain. Pleasure might cause her read, reading might make her know, knowledge might pity win and pity grace obtain. I sought fit words to paint the blackest face of woe, studying inventions fine, her wits to entertain, oft turning others' leaves to see if thence would flow some fresh and fruitful showers upon my sunburned brain. But words come halting forth, wanting invention. Stay, invention, nature's child, fled stepdame studies blows, and others' feet seem still, but strangers in my way. Thus great with child to speak and helpless in my throes, biting my truant pen, beating myself for spite. Fool, said my muse to me, look in thy heart and write. Pianists, some of you may not have heard before, Barbara Sutton Curtis. Beautiful, very, very, very talented. Now that we've built up our sense of awareness through our embrace, our understanding of our human nature and our creativity by exposure to Philip Sidney's sonnet, a little bit of a, more than a little bit of a reality check about our background and what we can learn from it. If we choose to learn anything, those who are already immune to learning from history can sign off and as usual, as they will. We're talking about again the perspective of from Europe, let's put it that way, on the expansion of masonry in Britain that was going on in Britain. If I ever give the illusion that it was only happening in Britain, I apologize for that. I'm reading because this is so much was written. It's an extensive field of study, and at the time, I want to get into the downside of imperialism. It goes, it is what it is. No, it's far more. It's still impactful, and I don't wish to. It's too upsetting for me to get into, so I don't want to do that. But I want to take your attention back to perspective. Something was happening, and like everything, as it evolves, it becomes refined or it becomes oppressive. In this case, it became refined. The imperialism, the battles, and all that have changed in a way. The thinking has, and the history is still with us. You don't escape all of that, I think. So let's have it. Talking here about the observations of particularly and what we did, we know that we were talking about at last word on this German Freemasons. I would tend to think Bavaria maybe, but could be wrong. As early as the 1740s, hotly denied that they were in any way atheist, rebels, or unmanly. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the charges of political subversion, irreligion, and sodomy were most commonly made against the society, and generally made in the same breath. And the sodomy that they were talking about is masturbation. An unpleasant word, yeah. Masturbation, that was considered sodomy. Explains some things, doesn't it? Particularly in Catholic countries such as France and Belgium, hostile critics might have been placated had they been privy to some of the Masonic degrees. Certain of the higher degrees practiced in French Freemasonry had Christian connotations. For example, the grade of Chevalier Élu, the elected knight, at his initiation into the degree, a brother promised to adore God and to be faithful to my king and charitable toward my brothers and to defend the Christian religion with the last drop of my blood. Other French Masons tried to give the secular symbolism used in Masonic art a Christian connotation. Well, of course they would. In these efforts, for example, the triangle became a symbol of the Trinity, the three persons of the divinity who enlightened the vast universe. as we shall see in the last, in the upcoming work, French Freemasonry could be just as aristocratic and Christian as was Republican or Deist. Occasionally, pious German orators also spoke of the lodges as intended to make men Christ-like. And always the charge of impiety is refuted. Yet at other moments, the ancient goddess Isis and Minerva are named as patrons, and the religion of Noah and the patriarchs is invoked. It was then up to each brother to determine what might be meant. In 1774, an orator in Brussels bluntly asked what the constitutions of 1723 meant when it spoke about obeying the moral law, about the religion in which all men can agree. Among the conclusions at which a brother might arrive, if only fancifully, was that since Masonry was as old as either Christianity or Judaism, as the almanacs told him, brothers might in fact be closer to their values, in their values, to the ancient Romans. Masonic almanacs regularly gave a synopsis of each month, which related that month to pagan mythology. March, so named and concentrated, to the god Mars or Romulus on the supposition that he was his son. The first month of the Roman year, and so the almanac went month by month, at the same time giving the saint's name for each day along with the monthly phases of the moon. Year after year, these largely French-language almanacs gave a truncated history of the Roman Republic and its gods. Sometimes they compared this temple of equality to the Roman Senate and found even the Romans less agreeable than this newly founded center of order and legality. And in 1793, we find Amsterdam Freemasons celebrating the Roman feast of Saturn on Christmas Day. Saturnalia, eh? Earlier French Freemasons wrote treatises on the ancient Druids of Gaul, similarities between the Masonic morals, ceremonies, and customs and those of the ancients. Perhaps we can better understand why some historians have seen in Enlightenment the rise of modern paganism. Ooh. My goodness. So dares to suggest that we're going around. Yeah. Have we excited the imagination once again? I hope so. I hope so. Have we brought attention to some of the to values and to the depths of Masonry? And have we brought a bit more meaning to your day and increased your understanding a little bit, a little bit? At least you can reflect on how you've been attending Masonic effects, and I would wonder if I could be so bold as to think that it might have had some effect on, some positive effect on your thinking, on your being, on your approach to the craft. I at times the frustrations as I grow older become less and less, and I see Masonry in a broader and deeper and more enriched way. It's now gone from the banquet to being in this atmosphere with you, where the music and the meal, the wine, it's exquisite. It's just exquisite. The experience the conversation is enlivened, and that's what, you know, in our humble way, that's what we're trying to do here at Masonic Effects. thank you very much for your attention this week, brethren. My hat goes off to brethren in Japan, to brethren in China, and Pakistan, in Sudan, in Zambia. A lovely nation, Zambia. And Brazil. We look over in the western part, Brazil, Britain, and Ireland, of course, yeah, and Canada and the United States. Thank you for your ongoing support. But I guess it's like saying thank you for being a Freemason and connecting that and savoring. You like a little history, a little poetry, some jazz, and the odd commentary, and I do mean odd in capital letters, then Masonic Effects is the place for you. Struggle by this week for another week. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. It will scare the world because nobody will expect it. What are you really up to, brother? You're doing something from the generosity of your heart? How dare you redefine the human condition? I'll look forward to being with you again soon, and thanks.